Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Din and Daf. I'm Alana Steinhain, and we are going to conceptualize a halachic principle this week from the Daf, as we do every week. Sorry for last week's hiatus. It is great to be back with you. And I had the good fortune of meeting two Dafyomi learners from Hadron, who I've been learning with, unbeknownst to me, for these past several months. So if I'm ever in a place where we see each other, please, please, please come up and say hi, because learning is about creating community. It is not just about content. It is also about the community of learners. So it was really a joy to meet those two people, and I look forward to meeting more. So we're going to talk about a principle that's come up a few times in these last couple of weeks in the Daf, and that is Zachen La'adam Shelo B'fanav. That essentially, I can perform a transaction on someone else's behalf for them without their knowledge, if that transaction is a gain for them. Now, implicitly and then explicitly elsewhere, or not elsewhere, but explicitly, that means if it's not something that is a gain for them, I can't do that without them knowing, without their knowledge. But I want to focus on this concept because I think it raises two really significant questions. One is the relationship between people. Meaning, how are we all connected? If I'm able to do something on your behalf and it sticks, even without your knowledge, what does that say about the connectivity of people? And the second is, how much do we actually care what you think or care what you want? It seems like we're assuming what you want. Do we care what you want? Or do we just say, if we define it as a zechut, if we define it as a positive, then the transaction works, right? So those are the two questions that I want to ask today. I mean, of course, they're all in a legal frame, right? Like, legally, how connected are we? And legally, to what extent do we care, subjectively how you feel versus some sort of objective measure of how you know if something is a net gain or not? So in order to start this conversation, we're going to look at a Mishnah in Gittin. The Mishnah in Gittin, Perek Aleph, Mishnah Vav, is talking about if somebody decides that they're going to give a get, meaning a get, a writ of divorce, or a situation of what we call a get shechurur, a writ of freedom or a writ of emancipation to an eved kenani. But instead of giving it directly to the person, they give it to somebody else and essentially say, take this on behalf of the woman whom I'm divorcing. Or meaning, like, once I give it to you, you are Zoche on it, you are attaining it on her behalf, or take this writ of emancipation on behalf of the Eved Kanani that I am emancipating, right? So that's what happens here, okay? The Mishnah is going to make it sound like he's just saying, here, give this to my wife or give this to my Eved. But the Gemara explains that the way we understand this is they're actually saying, like, take it on their behalf, okay? So ha'omer, when somebody says, "Tain get zel ishti," give this get, really accept this get, on behalf of my wife. Ushtar shechur zel avdi, or accept this writ of emancipation on behalf of my eved. So what is the status of that transaction, right? I didn't give it to my wife, and I didn't give it to my eved. I gave it to somebody else to accept it on their behalf. So there is a machloket. The Mishnah starts with the opinion of Rabbi Meir. Im ratza lachzor bishnehen, yachzor, divrei Rabbi Meir. So Rabbi Meir says, I actually think that transaction of either the divorce or the emancipation has not yet gone through. If the husband or the master decides that they want to go back, renege, they can, right? Just because they had somebody else perform the transaction of accepting it on behalf of the Isha or on behalf of the Eved doesn't make it binding and effectuated. That's Rabbi Meir's view. The Chachamim say, no, there's a difference. The two cases are different. Begite nashim, in a case of a writ of divorce for a woman, that's when, if the husband wants to renege, he still can. even though it seemed that somebody was trying to perform the acceptance of it on her behalf. But he cannot renege, the master cannot renege in a case of giving a writ of emancipation to someone else on behalf of their evet. Why? What's the difference between these two cases? Because while you are allowed to do something that's in someone's interest on their behalf, you are not allowed to do something that is not in their interest on their behalf if they did not appoint you. And what is essentially being said? That in the case of a get, the assumption is that it is not good for the woman to be divorced, right? And therefore, when the husband says, accept this on behalf of my wife, the transaction is not effectuated. But when it comes to freeing a slave is a net positive for that slave. And therefore, when the master says, here, take this on behalf of my slave, it works, even though it's totally unbeknownst to the slave. So the Mishnah continues to explain, why is it that in the case of a get, we assume that the divorce is a chovah for her, it's a negative for her. But in the case of shichrur avadim, we assume that it is a negative zochut for him. Why? Because she'im yirtzeh shelo lazunet avdo, reshai. Because if an owner of an eved kanani decided that they didn't want to give rations to their eved, in theory, they could do that, which means that the fact is that just because the eved is no longer going to be provided with rations, now that they're free, it's possible that they wouldn't have had rations even when they were an eved. So essentially, the argument here is, it is a net gain for them to have their freedom, and the loss of losing rations every day is not a real loss, because in theory, they could have lost their rations as an eved too. But what about a woman? V'shelo lazunet ishto eino reshai. The man can't unilaterally decide not to give his wife the food she needs to survive. And if that's the case, then the net loss when she gets divorced is that nobody is providing her with food. So when we look at somebody who says to a third party, accept this get on behalf of my wife, we say, that's a case of chavin la'adam shelo b'fanav, or shelo b'fanah, right? That's a case of doing something negative to the woman, because you're now depriving her of her food. But when it comes to take this writ of emancipation on behalf of my eved, what we're doing there is only a zechut for the eved, because they could be deprived of food even as an eved, right? So that's interesting. That's the distinction. So Rabbi Meir fires back. Amar lahem. Rabbi Meir says, wait a second. Why do you think it's a net gain for the eved to go free? V'harehu posel et avdo min hatruma. Kishem shehu posel et ishto. Actually, there is a negative. There is a loss for this eved. The eved, if they are an eved of a kohen, is no longer going to be allowed to eat from truma. That is a loss. It's something they could only do when they were an eved, and now they won't be able to do it. The same way, if a woman who was married to a kohen divorced and wasn't going back to her own kohen family, she wouldn't be allowed to eat the kohen's food anymore, right? She wouldn't be allowed to eat truma, right? So I actually think, says Rabbi Meir, I think they're both net negatives, right? I want you to notice that the whole conversation here revolves around the question of finances, right? Is it a financial benefit or is it a financial loss for somebody to get divorced or for somebody to get emancipated, right? The Chachamim then fire back. Amru lo, they say, well, mipnei shehu kinyano. Well, this whole thing is actually only because the Eved only gets the Truma in the first place because the Eved is considered the acquisition of their master. Now, what exactly is being said here? Is it there are other aspects of, you know, being an eved that could be taken away because that person is just a kinyan? What exactly is being said here is not necessarily clear, but suffice to say, the Chachamim think that there is something that is net positive about getting out of avdut, and there is something that is net negative of getting out of a divorce. Now, let's keep in mind, we're obviously not talking about an aguna case. What becomes, I think, very difficult is, let's say you're in an aguna situation, God forbid, right? Here, we're assuming it's a healthy marriage or healthy-ish. She doesn't want to be divorced. She wants to be supported, right? So just to give a divorce to somebody on her behalf, that's no good. Doesn't work, right? So what we see from here is we're looking at this aspect of zachin versus chavin. Is it a merit or is it a negative? And that seems to be defined more by finances than by anything else, right? Now, the question is, where does this concept even come from, right? And of course, the Gemara is going to take up the question of where the concept comes from, because the concept itself seems to come from something that itself is pretty financial, but also has significance, like I would say, like in a religious sense or in a status sense or in an identity sense, right? Like, it's interesting, you know, avdut and lahavdil, ishut, and the example we're about to see of acquiring land, acquiring a plot of land in Israel. These are all like pretty identity shaping transactions. This isn't like selling a shovel on a Tuesday, right? Like, it's so funny, you know, you're not supposed to give gifts on Shabbos unless somebody's going to be able to use it on Shabbos. But one thing you can do is you can have someone, or you can acquire it on behalf of the other person, because zachem adam shelo b'fanav, before Shabbos, and it's considered theirs, and then you give it to them on Shabbos, but it's been theirs all along. That's like the most prosaic, mundane example, right? These examples are like you're divorcing somebody without their knowledge, right? And that's, you know, much earlier in our halachic history, but it is interesting that it's such an intense issue and situation. So the place where the Gemara in Kiddushin, Daf Membet Amud Aleph, says it comes from is actually from the Shvatim, the tribes being promised land in Eretz Yisrael. So let's take a look at first the Pasuk that the Gemara is going to use, and then what the Gemara itself does, because it's going to start bringing us into the logic behind Zachin L'Adam Shelo B'Fanav. So the Pasuk is, V'nasi echad, nasi echad, mimateh, tikhu l'ncholat ha'aretz. So you're going to take one nasi, one prince from each tribe, and that's who's going to acquire the land on behalf of, presumably, like a whole tribe, right? So there you got one person who's acquiring the land. I also want to point out, it's certainly not going to be in front of all the people for whom they're acquiring it. Some of those people aren't even born yet, but certainly it's not going to be in front of all the people who are acquiring it and giving them permission or asking them to do that on their behalf, right? It's a ritualized form of apportioning this land. So the Gemara in Kiddushin really struggles with this pasuk and tries to figure out what we can learn from it, and has like three attempts. And one of those attempts is Zachin L'Adam Shelo B'Fanav. So here we go. And the context is, you know, the Gemara is talking about having a shaliach to perform kiddushin, to be mekadesh an isha, right? So shlichut, being an emissary, is the context of this, which is also where somebody does something on someone else's behalf. So here we go. Belahada Amar Rav Gidol Amar Rav, that which Rav Gidol Amar Rav says, and we're coming in medias res, we're coming in the middle of something, but we're just going to pick it up where it is. Minayin Sheshluchu Shel Adam Kimoto. How do we know that a person's emissary is like the person themselves, right? So I send somebody to do something, it's ki'ilu, I did it. It has the same binding status. It works. Shene'emar, as it says, v'nasiyachad, nasiyachad mimateh, because we have this pasuk in Bamidbar Lamed Aled that says one nasi from each tribe is going to do something on behalf of all the people, is going to get the land on behalf of all the people, right? So say, ah, tepukle shlichut mehacha. Maybe we should learn shlichut from here. We don't learn shlichut from here. Well, there are a number of places that we learn shlichut from, but that's not our topic for today. But the idea is let's learn the principle of being an emissary from here, of shlichut. So Gemara says, no. V'tisbara daha shlichuti. Think about it. Do you really think that this is a case of shlichut? This is a case of being an emissary? V'haktanim lav bnei shlichut ninu. Ktanim, minors, can't appoint a shaliach. And obviously, the land is also being inherited by minors. So, can't use that pasuk. Clearly, there's somebody working on behalf of a bunch of people, but we can't use that pasuk for shlichut because it seems to apply to people who can't make shlichim. So, attempt number two. Ela, okay, let's try again. Kiha de Rava bar Rav Huna, like Rava bar Rav Huna says. Da amar Rava bar Rav Huna, bar Rav Huna, amar Rav Gidol amar Rav. So says Rav Huna, I don't know why I'm having such trouble with that, says in the name of Rav Gidol, in the name of Rav. How do we know that you can do something that's in the interest of another person on their behalf without their knowledge? As it says, these princes from each tribe are able to do something on behalf of their whole tribe, clearly without being appointed by their entire tribe, by every single person, and not even being known by every single person. Right? So that's zachin la'adam shel b'fanav. It's a real zechut. They get a portion in the land of Israel. So you're going to say, wait. V'tisbra zechuti. Wait, is it logical to say that it's only a zechut to get land in Israel? Hachov anami ika. It's also negative. De'ika de'nichalei bahar v'lo nichalei bevika. Some people would rather have a hilly area. They wouldn't want to have a valley area. V'ika de'nichalei bevika v'lo nichalei bahar. And then other people would rather have a valley area and they would rather not have a hill area, right? It's like, in our family, we have something called you get what you get and you don't get upset. But the fact is you have to say that because people get what they get and they do get upset, right? So the question of, is it a zechut? Is it full, complete zechut or not, right? And the Gemara drops it and moves on to Elak the Rav Bar Rav Huna. No, it's this other Rav Bar Rav Huna statement. To Amar Rav Bar Rav Huna, Amar Rav Gidol, Amar Rav, says Rav Bar Rav Huna, the name of Rav Gidol, the name of Rav. Minayin liyatomim shabo lachlok b'nichsei avihen. From where do we know that orphans, sadly, that are, they're young, right? They're minors that come to divide up their father's property, that Beitin gives them an apotropos. Beitin gives them a representative, like a steward for their stuff until they grow up. Both lachuv, both for negative and also this quote and also for positive, right? How do we know? And the Gemara says, wait, what do you mean? Lachuv amai? What? Why would they do something negative to them? That's a bad idea. Ela lachuv al menat lis kot, meaning how do we know that we give people an apotropos? We give these yetomim ketanim, these orphans who are minors, we give them a steward to even be able to do something that in the short run is negative in order to get to a net positive. Talmud Lomar, as it said, nasi achad mimatatikhu, right? Take one nasi from each shevet, in order to get the land. So meaning, even if it's a land you don't love that it's so hilly, ultimately you get land in Eretz Yisrael, right? So this is really interesting. It's clear that the Gemara is trying to figure out, like, what kind of representation is this? How does this work exactly? Does it have to be something that's only a zechut, or can it even be something that has like a little bit of chova in it on the way to zechut, right? So this is where we land. Now, even though the Gemara seemed to kind of leave behind the idea that the Nasiachad is the source for Zachan Ladam Shelo Bafanav. The concept and this whole conversation that revolves around the question of, well, are we talking about a case of Shlichut, being an emissary? No, because there are minors involved. Are we talking about a case of Zachan Ladam Shelo Bafanav? Maybe not, because it's not a full Zachut, right? Are we talking about an apotropos, a steward for Yitomim Ketanim, for orphans who are underage, right? Yes, that's what we're talking about. It's interesting. These are three, it seems, different forms of what it means to do something on someone else's behalf, be able to effectuate transactions. And when the Rishonim and the Achronim try to figure out what exactly is the basis of Zachan La'adam Shelo Bafanav, it's really interesting that even though the Gemara seemed to reject that, you know, shlichut could not be done by a minor, right? And if we say that zachin could even be done for a minor, right, then you wouldn't think that zachin is because of shlichut. And yet, Rashi in Gittin, Ted Amud Bet says, v'zachin lo la'adam shelo bafanav, you are allowed to perform a transaction that is in someone's interest, even on their behalf, even if they don't know about it. Why da'anan sade d'nichle d'nehavi ha'ishluch alahachi? Because we all know, we're all witnesses, we all know that this person who's getting the benefit, they're very happy for this person to be their shaliach, right? They're very happy for this other person to be their shaliach. Almost like, zachan lo la'adam shelo bafanav, even though they didn't make you their emissary, we all know that because it's a zechut, they would have made you their emissary. And so, like, that's enough, right? So they basically suggest that even though the Gemara makes a distinction, it seems, between shlichut and zachan la'adam shelo bafanav, that Rashi seems to think, and others along with him, that zachan la'adam shelo bafanav is actually based on some concept of shlichut. And it seems to me, when I look at that concept of shlichut, that anan sade, we are all witnesses that this person would have loved for you to be their shaliach, it's really kind of saying, you know, we still care about the agency of the person who's going to get it at the end of the day. We just think that that person would have made you their shaliach. And so that, like, shlichut and potential is good enough. So zachan la'adam shelo bafanav, because they would have wanted you to be their shaliach, right? Now that's very different, I think, than another suggestion as to where zachan la'adam shelo bafanav comes from, which you see in the Ketzot HaChoshen. And in the Ketzot HaChoshen, you see the following. Dat kama harishonim she'amru, some of the rishonim think, dizachia mitorat yad amru, velo mitorat shlichut. That the ability to effectuate this transaction of being able to be, like, even zoche on something, to be able to even acquire something on someone else's behalf without their knowledge, if it's good for them, that's not about shlichut. That's not about being an emissary. It's like you're their yad, like you're their hand, right? Now that's really interesting. We saw this in the daf, a conversation about maybe someone's chatzer, right? Someone's property is like their hand. That feels very different to me, to say that zachan la'adam shelo bafanav is based on suggesting that the person who's zoche on it for them is like their hand. That to me doesn't say anything about the agency of the person who's ultimately going to get it. Whether they want to or not, like, you don't tell your hand, oh, hand, you should stay here, right? Like, I know that at some subconscious level, but if somebody sticks something in my hand, right, or like tapes it to my hand, I may have no agency in that conversation. I may make no decision in that conversation, right? Similar to if somebody threw something in my chatzer, somebody threw something in my property. It's not really focused on the agency of the person who's ultimately going to get it, the way that shlichut is focused on the agency of the person who's actually going to get it, right? So I think these are two very different things, right? And by the way, the Ketzot then adds, v'afilu l'man da'amr dizchia mitorat shlichut, even those who do say, like we just said on Rashi's behalf, that this acquisition on someone else's behalf is actually based on shlichut, I want to clarify, Not the way Rashi says it. Lav mishum anan sade da'asa o shaliach. It's not because we have some sense of, well, the person would have wanted to make them a shaliach anyway. Ela d'gzirat ha-katuv sheyehei hazocha la'acher mahani. It's a gzirat ha-katuv. It's based on scriptural decree, right? So like there's two tracks in being a shaliach. One track in being a shaliach is we know that the person would have made you a shaliach, or maybe they had to make you a shaliach. Another is we have a special scriptural decree that says you count as a shaliach for this person, right? Now, that also sounds to me a little bit like we don't care so much about their agency, right? Because it's like the Torah made them a shaliach. You didn't make them a shaliach. The Torah made them a shaliach. So either you're part of their body or the Torah made a decision for you, right? That's very different than anan sadeh. We all are witness to the fact that nichle, this person would have wanted, that they would have wanted this person to be their shaliach, right? So the first question that we asked about the issue of zachin la'adam shelo b'fanav is, or I keep leaving out the lo, zachin lo adam shelo b'fanav, right? The first issue that we asked about is how much, or really the second issue that we asked about is how much do we really care about what you feel? Well, if it's a shlichut model on the logic of anan sadeh d'nichle d'nahavi hai shlucho l'achi, then we do care what you think. And we want to know what you think. And based on what you think, that's what's going to determine if that this works, right? But based on the idea that the zachna l'adam shel b'fanav is based on yad, or even maybe it's based on shlichut, but it's a shlichut that's a gzeirat ha-katuv, we care very little about what the person themselves thinks, it seems, right? It's kind of interesting. And I would say it's almost like a seesaw, right? It's like, to the extent that we care so much about what the person on whose behalf you're doing this really feels and really cares about, it's like we're giving them independence from you, right? Like what they think matters. But to the extent that we just consider you an extension of them, right? We're giving them less independence and we're also giving you deeper connectivity with them, right? Like you are their yad. That's very powerful from a legal perspective. You are an extension of them, right? So these are two perspectives on the logic of where this comes from. Now, what I would say is we have another heuristic or litmus test. That's the word I'm looking for. We have another litmus test in Zachan Mola Adam Shelo B'fanav, right? Like you could say that what we were just talking about is like the La Adam part. Is it based on Shlichut or is it based on Yad? But now we also have to talk about Zachan, right? Like what makes it a Zachut? Who decides that it's a Zachut? And let's take a look at two different approaches on who decides that it's a zechut. Not that they're necessarily mutually exclusive, they're kind of on a spectrum, on a continuum, but it's interesting to consider that, again, when we ask who decides whether it's a zechut or not, it's actually a similar question. Like, is this objectively defined as, when something is objectively legally defined as a zechut, like, I don't know, an eved getting free. Right? That didn't seem to be about how does the eved feel about getting free. It seemed to be about what financial benefits or deficits is that person accruing, right? Or are we actually, do we care about their feelings, right? Do we care about their feelings? So let's take a look at the Rambam, Hilchot Zechiyu Matana, Perek Dalid, Halacha Bet, okay? If somebody is transferring ownership to their friend of a gift through a third party, once that third party has physically taken it, meaning, for example, they did an act of kinyan, right? They did an act of acquisition. So if it's metaltalin, if it's portables, they did mashicha on them. Right, they moved it, like they dragged it. Oh, he giya shtar hakarka liado. Or if we're talking about property, if we're talking about non-movable property, the shtar, right, the contract for it came to that person's hand, right? Oh, hechazik bakarka. Or the person actually did something that shows a chazaka over the land, meaning that shows that they own the land, right? So maybe, I don't want to say this offhand, what's considered chazaka in this way, but let's something along the lines of, I don't know, like digging a hole in the ground or something, right? So once they do that kinyan action, zacha chaviro, they're that person on whose behalf they did it, right, is considered to have acquired that non-movable property or that movable property, as the case may be. Afal pi shelo higia hamatana liyado, even though the gift has not yet reached their hands. Ve'ein hanotein yachol lachzor. And the key issue of the binding nature of this transaction is that the giver is not allowed to renege. The gift has been given. They are not allowed to renege. Aval, but by the way, Hamekabel yado ala elyona, the person on whose behalf this was done, who's going to ultimately get this item, they still have a lot of leeway. Im ratza mekabel, if they want, they can choose to accept it from the third party who already got it on their behalf. And im lo ratza eino mekabel, if they don't want it, they don't have to take it, right? Now, this sounds very subjective. Shezachin la'adam shelo b'fanav, ve'ein chavin lo ela b'fanav, right? Because we only do a zechut for somebody, not in front of them, but not something that's a demerit. Uzechut hu shetinatein lo matana im yirtzeh. It is a zechut to be given a gift if you want it. But if they don't want it, you don't give somebody a gift against their will, right? So here, the way the Rambam presents this, and notice he's not talking about status here, right? He's talking about acquisition of property. He's not talking about the examples that we were saying about an Eved or an Isha before, right? He's talking about property, and it's very subjective. If the person wants the property, then it's a zechut. And if the person doesn't, then it's not, right? Now, it's interesting to ask, okay, so what happens with the property if the original giver can't give it back, right? So, interesting question that comes up. So that's like at one end of the spectrum. It's very subjective. We care so much what the person on whose behalf you're doing this thinks. And then I want to say, at the other end of the spectrum, we have an example like the Ramban on Kiddushin Kaf Gimel Amud Aleph, which is talking about a situation of freeing a slave, which according to Chachamim is considered a zechut in that Mishnah that we read at the beginning, right? Gittin Aleph of. It's considered a zechut. Why? Because objectively, this person is not losing anything, right? It's not like they're losing their access to food. They could have lost that when they were an Eved, right? You could also argue, and this discussions go back and forth, it's not like they're losing even food of a Kohen because, and this is what some people think the end of that Mishnah meant, where it's, well, this person is only eating the truma because they're a kinyan, because they're an acquisition of their master. Is some people say it means, the master can decide. One second, I stop the share. I realize it's a little bit difficult. Yeah, sorry. The master can decide to sell him to a Yisrael, sell the Eved to a Yisrael, and then they're not going to have truma either, right? And maybe some people also talk about maybe there are gains because before the Eved can only marry a Shifcha Kenanit. And now different options are open, right? So it's interesting. And then other people say he would rather be married. It's a different conversation. But the point is, it seems to be that in that discussion of the get shichrur, the writ of emancipation for an Eved, we just weren't as subjective about it of, the way the Rambam just described, do you want the matana or do you not want the matana? People were kind of like, well, legally is this described as a zechut or legally is this described as a chova? And so the Ramban, when talking about that, and we'll go back to share screen, Ramban, when talking about that, says on it's in the middle, but we'll just go with this. It says Hu Hadin Da'afilu Nami Bal Korcho. This would also be the case of being able to get a writ of emancipation for a slave to free them, even against that slave's wishes. Meaning, even if that slave says, no, I want to stay indentured. I want to stay indentured. We define it as a zechut anyway. And the Ramban adds, and this I think complicates sort of the purity of the question of, are we asking if the person themselves gets to determine whether something is a zechut, or are we saying there's something legally defined as a zechut? Because he adds, saying the reason why it works, if it's against that the Eved's wishes, is Mishum Tami de Rava, for the reason delineated by Rava on that Amud, which is De Kesef Kabbalat Rabo Garmalo, that the fact is the money that the master receives is actually what effectuates the transaction, right? So ultimately, the fact that somebody, ultimately, the fact that somebody did this transaction on behalf of the Eved, if we're talking about Kesef at least, if we're talking about money passing from somebody to the master in order to free the slave, then even if the slave wanted to stay indentured, the zechut would still accrue to the slave and he would still be freed, because ultimately the transaction is effectuated by the master accepting the money, rather than the transaction really being effectuated by whoever is acting on the Eved's behalf giving the money, right? So it's a little bit complicated, and it moves us out of just like the clean imagining that the master is giving someone a writ of emancipation on behalf of the Eved. That may not work against the Eved's wishes, even though it's a zechut, because ultimately it's the acceptance of something on behalf of the Eved that is supposed to be at play here, that is supposed to make the transaction work. But at the very least, in a situation of kesef, where somebody would give the master money on the Eved's behalf in order to emancipate the Eved, it might even work bal korcho shel the Eved. It might even work against the wishes of the Eved to emancipate that person, because the transaction is ultimately effectuated by the master accepting. So it's not like a clean conversation of just who decides what the zechut is, but it's still in there, right? Meaning, it's still the question of whether it's an objective zechut or if it is has to be a subjective zechut is still there. So what I hope we've seen is something that, a concept that is as pervasive as, trying to effectuate a status change on someone's behalf, to as, daily conversations of trying to accept a matana on somebody's behalf. And we didn't even talk about like trying to do a mitzvah on somebody's behalf, like a pidyon haben on somebody's behalf, for example, right? The conversation of zachen la'adam shelo b'fanav, sort of what's at the heart of the conversation, is both what can somebody else do for you, because are they considered connected to you? And really at the heart of the heart is, how much do we care about what you think, right? Do we need you to make someone your shaliach in order to have something happen? Do we need you to think that something is a zechut in order for it to be considered a zechut? Or can we legally define things in a way that moves beyond the sort of idiosyncratic, subjective way of looking at things? So thanks everybody for joining me, and it is always a pleasure. I wish everybody I'm gonna say a meaningful Purim this year, and I actually want to end by saying I think it's a very difficult year for Purim, and I just want to suggest four quick themes that might be useful for people to think about this Purim as they're dealing with everything. I would say one really important theme, I think, is The first is Tanit Esther. Just thinking about the fact that Tanit often this year in Tanit Esther, it doesn't feel like we are acting out the moment where Esther or the Jewish people do not know how the story will end. But we really know the ending. I think this year we really, really don't know the ending. And I think we should have that in mind in this Tanit. The war. I think there is a lot in Megillat Esther about war and the feeling of betrayal from of Jews by their neighbors, an ability to win against all odds, and a discussion about the importance of morality, of not taking the spoils in war, which is in the Megillah. The third, I would say, the social mitzvot of Purim, the Mishloach Manot and Matanot Le'Avyonim, which really reminds me of the Rambam's warning that in general, the difference between Simchat Mitzvah and Simchat Kriso, the difference between the joy of a mitzvah and the joy of your stomach, is the question of who are you taking care of with the food that you're eating? And I hope that people gain a lot of meaning out of trying to provide for others this Purim. And I would say the last is something that I don't usually think much about, which is the Gemara's conversation about getting drunk enough on Purim, Ad lo yada ben Arur Haman leBaruch Mordechai, until we don't know the difference between cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordechai. And I would say that many of us feel that we are living in a very topsy-turvy world where Haman is getting praise and Mordechai is getting curses heaped upon him. And it's really important to be able to think clearly in such a world. Wishing everybody a meaningful prayer.